For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
All right, welcome back. I hope you are all as excited as I am that it's Monday night and that we're back in action. And just exciting for the shul, exciting for all of you, and I'm excited that you're here to join me on this adventure of the great controversies in Jewish history. Tonight's class has been sponsored by Alan and Roberta Scheer in memory of my grandfather, Reb Simcha Zimmel ben Usher Zelig, and I very much appreciate their sponsorships and all that everyone else has done in his memory over the last 2 or 3 months. So tonight's learning should be as a schus in memory of him. Our class, in general, the course, has been sponsored by the Ovadia family in memory of Yossi's parents, Shimon Shlomo and Margalit Ovadia. And as we begin tonight, last week we of course had Rav Vera Wine, was a special treat. As we begin tonight, our regularly scheduled program, I've asked Yossi just to spend a minute, and he's going to share a word or two about his parents as the course has been dedicated in their memory.
Good evening, everybody. About my mom and dad, I welcome all of you to join my family and I in honoring my mother and father meaningful memories. Around 1943, my mom and dad made Aliyah to Israel from Eden. Both were holding a British passport, when they arrived to Palestine in their theme. Eden, as in the Garden of Eden, was under British control and located near Yemen, near the Saudi Arabia Peninsula. My father served in the British Army and joined the Herut Party with Menachem Begin. He started his own life, his own job. He had a company that does tiles, mosaic company in Petah Tikva, while he lived in Tel Aviv, where he lived with my mom, and he died in Tel Aviv too. My mom ran a cafeteria, like a restaurant, in a big steel company in Kfar Saba for many years. Both my parents were down to earth people, honest, hardworking human beings. They embodied all of the midot and the mitzvot which they taught me, my brother and my sister. They truly lived the value of charity, selflessness, and loving and respecting others. May my parents' memory, their great personality and great deed, endure with us forever. Thank you.
Thank you, Yossi. May the memories be for a blessing, and may all the studying and learning that we do over the course of these next several months be a memory, a schus for their memory. Tonight's class is on the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the Tzdukim and the Perushim. Befitting Jewish history, we are going to start out of order, because that's just the way that it should go. Technically speaking, the first class should be the Hellenists. That really is the beginning. That course is going to be given in 2 weeks. The Rabbis Emanuel and Ilan Feldman are going to be teaching that course. We pushed that course off so that it will be much more in line with Hanukkah, which will be just a few weeks after that. So that really is the basis. We're going a little bit out of order, but that's okay. As Rabbi Wein mentioned last week, on Monday, one of the themes that we're going to find over and over in Jewish history is Ein Dovar Chodosh Tachas Hashem. There's nothing new under the sun. The issues that we're going to read about and learn about and study about are issues which existed then, and they exist now. They often have different forms and different names, but the trials, the tribulations, the struggles that we've had throughout Jewish history are going to pop up over and over again. And one of the things that I hope we'll learn is having that perspective of seeing it in the big picture. And as Rabbi Wein mentioned last week, and we'll mention again tonight, the race is not necessarily run by the swift nor the battle by the strong. Jewish history is a long story. In the macrocosmic sense, in our own personal microcosmic senses, you have to let the story play itself out. And as we'll see, there are moments in history where it seems it's all over for the Jewish people. There are many moments like that in which you say, it's over, it's done, there's nothing we can do. You just need to wait it out, play itself out, and the perspective that we'll get from Jewish history of seeing that itself over and over again is very strengthening and a critical understanding for ourselves in 2,000 years of exile, understanding exactly how that works and what's been going on. Am I too loud?
No.
Not yet. Wait till I start screaming. Okay. All right, let's start. So the way, for those of you who have been here before, so the way that I like to run my classes, I have an outline which I'm basically going to be following. I have given you various quotes. The quotes are in boxes, and in pages 5 and 6 is an addendum in which I gave you the longer quotes of some issues which we are not going to read inside, and I didn't want to make the outline too clumsy with all these big quotes. I put them in the back, and I hope you'll have a chance to take a look and see them inside. We'll reference them as we go through as well. Okay, some historical background. So our story takes place following the Hanukkah story. That's where we are in context. If you want to look at your timeline, we are at the end in the Second Temple period, during the period at the conclusion of the Mishnah and the discussion of the Babylonian Talmud. We're in that general area of Jewish history, right prior to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. There are two major events in Jewish history which are going to set the stage, which are going to collide these two events and set the stage for our first controversy, that of the Sadducim, the Sadducees, and the Prushim, which are the traditional rabbinic figures in Jewish history. The first major event is the return to Israel and the rebuilding of the second temple. Following the first Beis HaMikdash, which takes place already during the time of Tanakh, which is our first year's course, the Jews are exiled primarily to Babylonia. That's where we have our Purim story. And then following the Purim story, the Jews return. Not in mass, it's a slow trickle at first, about 44,000 return. But those 44,000, led by Ezra and Nehemiah, they rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The second temple now stands, and they rebuild the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. This new community is fundamentally different than the original Jewish community that existed during the times of the First Temple. And as we've mentioned in both courses, in the Tanakh class as well as last year during our Svarim class, that change will forever change the nature of the Jewish people. Number one, the miraculous presence of Hashem no longer exists amongst the Jewish people. When you would go to the Second Temple, you did not see, feel, sense God's presence as you did during the first temple period. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos lists numerous miraculous events which existed during the first temple time, and none of them were there during the second temple. We were still and are still in exile. And an element of that exile was the loss of that presence. Together with the loss of that presence, we lost prophecy. When the Jews come back from that exile, the Babylonian exile, there are a few prophets left, amongst them Mordechai from the Purim story. They're with the Anshei Knesset HaGadol, the men of the Great Assembly, but when they die out, that's it for prophecy. With the end of prophecy comes also the end of the primary villain throughout all of Tanakh. And those of you who recall, what's the primary villain? Idolatry. The fear that the Jews had of idolatry, the lust that they had for idolatry, the desire for it, which we cannot understand, that also ends in this period as the Jews come back. And what was the primary villain no longer is the primary villain. Because it's all part of this fundamental shift out of prophecy, out of a clear revelation of God's presence. And what we shift into at this point are the sages taking center stage. And this is what we spoke about many times last year. The shift from the prophet as the leader of the Jewish people to the rabbi as the leader of the Jewish people. From prophecy to wisdom, to chachma, to being able to understand the Torah, delving into it, this is the development of the Mishnah and of the Talmud. It's a new type of understanding of God's Torah that's not being revealed to us through the prophets, but are being revealed to us through the oral law and the rabbis who knew and understood it. That's the new world that's being set up on the return of the Jews to the land of Israel and with the rebuilding of the second temple. The returning community was very weak and small. It was dominated by foreign tribes. There were Shomronim, who we're not going to get into, was a group of people who actually claimed that they were the real Jews, that when the Jews were exiled, they had been left behind, and they said, we're the Jews, you guys left. The sages had to deal with them. They had to deal with outside dominions from Persia, from Greece, from Egypt. It was a very localized community outside, around Yerushalayim. The mission actually describes during the Second Temple time, it only took 3 days of travel to get from Yerushalayim to the most outlying community that existed of Jews. Just 3 days. In the times of the first temple, it took 14 days of travel to get there. They were spread out. It was a developed community. But by the second temple period, it's much smaller and centralized. And what the sages did is developed what we recognize as normative traditional Judaism, which was the vehicle to survive this exile, the vehicle to survive being dispersed. And that was not loyalty to a nation. It wasn't loyalty to a government or to a place, but to an ideal. And that ideal was the belief and faith in the Torah. And the sages created for us the vehicle with which we would be able to survive not just the difficult period they were in then, but the sages foresaw a very long exile that we are at the tail end of now, 2,000 years later, and they gave us the vehicle to do so. And what they did is they gave us the synagogue. They gave us a shul. They gave us a siddur. They gave us a structure in which the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, would no longer be the central theme of Jewish life, but it could be a centralized theme without a Beis HaMikdash. It could be a centralized, this is even during when the Beis HaMikdash still stood, but it's during this period where the siddur developed. Chazal, the sages, gave us the tools and the vehicle that we would need to survive, so that we would be independent of place, we would be independent of being in governmental power, we would be independent of wealth. The Jew could survive anywhere. Because the sages saw what had happened, that with the destruction of the first temple, even with the building of the second temple, it wasn't the same. God's presence wasn't with us in the same way. And we have here a new vehicle for survivor. The Torah was going to be our government, the sages were going to be our leaders, and the Beis HaKnesses, the shul, was going to replace the temple as the lifeline, the Jewish lifeline to survival, and it can go anywhere. It can be anywhere, and the Jew can connect to the sages and its teachings through that. That's scene one that's going on. There's a fundamental shift in which we're moving out of prophecy into sages and the structure that they were creating for our survival. The other issue which is taking place at this time is the rise of Greece on the world scene. Now, Greece moves in, and they bring with them beauty and culture, art, architecture, music. Everything that Greece has introduced into the Western world is also introduced to the Jewish people at this time. Now, if you could just bring an analogy, as Rabbi Wein has done, between a Jew living in Poland with his non-Jewish neighbors, how tempted was he to be like them? And then you take the Jew living in Germany, surrounded by Bach, and all of the classics, and the literature, and the culture, and how difficult was it to remain a Shomer Shabbos Jew there? Those are two totally separate environments. As the Jews in Germany flocked to the Reform movement very differently than those did in the poverty-stricken areas of Eastern Europe. Well, when Greece steps in, this is no longer the Babylonians and the Assyrians with their idolatrous practices. This is Greek culture. And Jewish people, they're into this. So at the same time that we're shifting out of the prophecy into the sages as the lifeline, we also have, just like when it was prophecy, what was the force against prophecy? It's idolatry. When the force of idolatry is out and it's replaced with the sages and wisdom of the Torah, the force against that is the culture of the Greeks and all that it had to offer. And the Jews jump in. Estimated up to a third of the Jews become Hellenized, which means they are fully fledged, bought into Greek culture. Now, during the period, this is what Rabbi Stelman will talk about, and we're going to just touch on it very briefly here because it leads us to our story. During this time, the Jews, when they were Hellenized, they were still, a lot of them considered themselves Jews, but none of them claimed what they were doing is what Judaism stands for. It's just they really liked it and enjoyed it, and they did it. But it wasn't that Judaism had become that. It's that they didn't claim that. It's just that's what they were. That's who they were and what they had become. The Hanukkah story, so I'm just going right through that period. When the Hanukkah story happens and the Jews revolt and rebel against the Greeks that are in power at that time, and it was so decisive and so miraculous, it was no longer cool to be a Hellenist. It was just treason. A Jew, you couldn't walk around after the Hanukkah story when everyone's lighting their menorah and just telling over the story how God miraculously defeated the Greeks and the Hellenist culture and claim you were a Hellenist and think you're going to get anywhere. So what happened was that element sort of went underground. didn't disappear, because in the same way as Jews loved the Greek culture and art and architecture and music and sport, but now they saw that that wasn't quite right, so it dug down a little bit. And it's going to reemerge two generations later with the tzedukim. That's where Greek culture, the Greek way of life, is going to reemerge in a Jewish way. We're going to see it's not really a Jewish way, but reemerge from the Jews in what we're going to be studying about tonight from the tzedukim. Now, the tzedukim were a very powerful political force, and they were a powerful religious force. They were heretical sects, meaning they did not believe, as we're going to see, in Torah true Judaism as we know it to be for the last 3,300 years. But what they did is, while essentially espousing Greek ideals and values, they are going to package it as if it is Judaism. And that's going to be the big internal threat that we're going to have to Torah Judaism, is there's going to be a now large, powerful sect of Jews claiming that Judaism is something vastly different than what it had been. So it's no longer just a threat where I like Greek culture and I want to go to the theater and be a Jew. It's that I'm going to claim in my new version of Greek philosophy that that is what Judaism is. Now, the people against them are known as the Perushim. The Pharisees are going to be our traditional Jews. Literally translates as separatists, and they are the majority of the population, the traditional rabbinic Judaism. During this time, following again the Greek War, there really developed three major parties or groups within Judaism. The Pharisees, the Perushim, are the bulk, the majority, traditional rabbinic Judaism. The Tzedukim, the Sadducees, which we're going to be discussing tonight, are another major group, and we're going to see become very, very powerful. There's a third group, the Essenes, who are very extreme. They're going to be discussed primarily next week when Rabbi Dr. Michael Berger is going to be teaching the class on the development of Christianity. That group of Jews is really going to be the foundation of what will become Christianity. We're not going to be talking about them tonight, but they are a third group of Jews that's just important to recognize. There are really three, even though we're going to be primarily discussing two. This third group, again, very extreme, didn't marry. They were always in the mikvah with constant immersions. They were a very messianic and isolated group, and we'll be discussing a little bit about them and how they became reincarnated into Christianity. That will be Mirtz Hashem next week. Okay, well, what is the Sadducee philosophy? Who are these people? What became of them? And why did they become what they became? So interestingly, we don't have a single recorded record of any of their teachings. The only thing that we know about them actually comes from the Gemara, from that which the Talmud or the sages record about them, because there were many disputes between the Perushim and the Sadducees, and they're recorded in the Gemara. It's very hard. As I was preparing this class, I had many aha moments, having seen many pieces of Gemara that refer to different concepts that never made sense to me fully until you put it in the context of what were the Jews living like? What was the environment of this time period as the Mishnah and the Gemara is being written? Who were these people and why were the Jews so concerned with them? And we'll see that we have numerous practices even still today which are remnants and holdouts of this time period. What they held, what they believed, the Sadducees, is pretty clear, as we'll see in numerous sources. How it was that they got there is what's very interesting, and very interesting to us to note. As Rabbi Wein likes to say, the Hellenist lifestyle came first. This underground movement, this is 30, 40, 50 years, we'll see, after the revolution of Hanukkah. But that element of Jew, if you remember, it's a third of the Jewish population was into Hellenism. You're going to have a lot of Jews who were into that culture, a lot of Jews who were into that lifestyle. So that lifestyle culture came first, and then the philosophy to justify it came second. And that's a theme that we have in our personal lives, we have in historical lives. I'm already sold on a certain approach. This is what I feel, what I believe, what I want. And then I have to figure out a way to sort of make that work. So we're going to see here that tzedukim, what came first was a lifestyle. What came first was an approach. And then there was a philosophy that was built around that to explain it or to justify it. It starts from a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. All of the sources describing the tzedukim start from the Mishnah. From the very beginning of Pirkei Avos, it's on the box on the bottom of page 1. Antigonos Ish Socho. The leader of the place called Socho received the tradition from Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik was from the men of the Great Assembly. He gave the tradition to the next generation, Antigonus. And Antigonus used to teach the following lesson. Be not like servants who serve their master for the sake of receiving a reward. Instead, Antigonus taught, be like servants who serve their master, not for the sake of receiving a reward. And let the awe of heaven be upon you. That's his teaching. Two components. Number one, don't serve in order to receive a reward. You should serve your master not on condition to receive a reward. We would say, if we had to describe in a word, how does he want us to serve? Out of love. That's how the commentators understand. Don't do it because you're getting a reward. Don't serve your master like that. Serve your master not on condition to receive a reward. It should be done out of love. And then he combines, but if you only serve out of love, that's not so great. So he combines it at the end of his statement, he teaches, and you should also fear heaven. The love, fear, dichotomy, relationship, that's how a Jew has to serve. But his words were misunderstood, because he says the words, don't serve your master to receive a word, but reward, but serve your master not on the condition to receive a reward. So the sages record the following pattern that happened after this. In the bottom, Antigonus had two students, Tzadok and Baitus. They studied his words, and then they taught them to their students, and their students taught it to their students. So right away, as you read the words, they say, what are the sages teaching while introducing it like that way? So right away, you have a game of, I don't want to say telephone, but you already have several generations removed from the teacher. The teacher taught what he taught. He had two students who taught their students, and those students taught their students. And those students questioned, Maro avosenu, what did our teachers see or know that they would say such a thing? How can they say to serve, not to receive a reward? Is it possible that a laborer could toil an entire day, and not receive his wages at night? How could that be? If our teachers knew that indeed there was a world to come, and there was a concept of the resuscitation of the dead, they would not have said this. So they looked at this teaching and they said, according to this teaching...
One brief interruption.
Yeah.
A white Honda, BTS 1721, your lights are on.
Thank you.
Thank you. They said a white Honda with lights on... Oh, sorry. No, that's not what they said. They said they would not have said this. How can it be? How can it be that a teacher would teach that you should serve not to get reward? No reward? It must be there indeed is no reward. There is no resuscitation of the dead. There is no world to come. They left the way of the Torah and splintered into two groups known as the Tzadokim from Tzadok and Baitusim from Baitus. They were particular to always use gold and silver utensils, say the sages. Not that they were haughty. They weren't using them to say because we're so great, we're so special. But that they said, the Prushim, traditional rabbinic Judaism, they have a tradition. And their tradition is to abstain from indulgences in this world. But in the next world, they actually have nothing. So that the sages see, why did they use gold and silver? Because why not? Because the reason not to, the Prushim have this tradition of you should abstain from indulgences in this world. This world is an antechamber, simply the place to prepare for the banquet hall. But if there is no banquet hall, if there is nothing coming, well then what do I need to refrain? What do I need to be mitza'er myself? What do I need to pain myself not to have certain things? For what? So let me enjoy while I'm here. Sounds a lot like eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. The Rambam, Maimonides, when he comments on this Mishnah, adds a point to this. These two groups, he writes in the next box, left Jewish life and abandoned the Torah. But they saw they could not gather the multitudes to their movement. Judaism is well over 1,000 years, almost 2,000 years old at this point in history. Somewhere in 1,000 or 2,000 years. The Jews have been practicing for a long time. And all of a sudden these two groups say, no, nothing. Can't be. So nobody joined in. So they said instead, says Maimonides, the Rambam changes understand from that they changed their tune, that they believed in Torah. It was only against the tradition that they were arguing. It was the rabbis. It was the oral law. It was the rabbis' interpretation of the written law that we don't accept. Because to say that there is no Torah, well, that wasn't going to fly. Jews weren't going to go for that. To say that there's a Torah, but that the rabbis have twisted it, and that the rabbis have misinterpreted it, and that the rabbis have added it to it unnecessarily, well, that has a real appeal to the Jewish people. Because the Tzedukim weren't the only ones whose lifestyle was inhibited a little bit by rabbinic law. So now they changed their tune. The tune was, it's the rabbis that are the problem. The Torah we accept. Anything written in the Torah, we believe. It's true. But it's got to be literal. It's got to be in there. If the rabbis got their hands on it and interpreted it in some way, it's that we don't accept. Says the Rambam, all of this was to absolve themselves from the mitzvot and rabbinic decrees, as they can now expound upon any verse as they saw fit without any previous tradition. Everyone in this room knows, if I gave you a chumash, just a chumash, and nothing else, we can come up with whatever we wanted to. Because the chumash wasn't given alone. It was given together with an oral law that interpreted it. If you take out the oral law, and you take out the rabbi's authority, well then you can have your cake and eat it too. You can be a Torah Jew, you can be a believer, and you can really do whatever it is that you like. So the Rambam saw that's really where they were coming from. There was a lifestyle that came first and a philosophy that came to justify it. Just as an example, the rabbis put a tremendous amount of fences around Shabbos. Tremendous amount of fences around Shabbos. If it wouldn't be for rabbinic law around Shabbos, we would be just fine keeping Shabbos. We would have all of our timers. We could use non-Jews. We can come up with all sorts of ploys that wouldn't even be so complicated to really be able to do absolutely anything. It's doable. What prevents us from doing that? A lot of the rabbinic laws. The rabbinic law of not asking a non-Jew to do something for you. The rabbinic fence of muktzah. And numerous other rabbinic fences which kept the Shabbos as it needs to be. As has been explained by many before me, there's a zachar and a shamor, to observe and to keep Shabbos. So one can keep the shamor. I could be Shabbos observant, and yet I'm really not in any way actually living through the Shabbos, because I've found all my loopholes. So the sages came in and put in many fences, rules and regulations so that Shabbos should look the way that it's supposed to look. Well, one of those things were reading the newspaper on Shabbos. There was a decree of muktzah in the Athens Times. There was no riding on horses. There was no swimming. There was no going to the bathhouse. So you say, well, we're used to that. That's what Shabbos is. Well, if your Greek buddies and the culture you lived in did all those things, and it was the rabbis who told you not to, not the Torah itself. If the Torah itself was, all those things would be fine. It's all rabbinic. Well, that's very inhibiting. And there's this is my life. This is my friends. These are my culture. This is what I do. So your ire and irk is driven towards, it's the rabbis that are the problem. The Torah is fine. So is rabbis. Meanwhile, the rabbis knew what they were doing. The rabbis have preserved Judaism for 3,300 years, getting us to where we are today, to still be talking about the Tzedukim. If it wouldn't be for the rabbis, we wouldn't be here talking about the Tzedukim, because Judaism wouldn't exist as we know it. But that's what they were against. They were against that. And that, as I introduce this, we're going to see elements of the philosophy play itself out throughout history and within ourselves also. We have the same problem, all of us in our own individual ways. When you come ask myself or Rabbi Feldman a question, the answer is no, and you wanted it to be yes, and the reason is rabbinic law, and you walk out saying, that's right, I mean, come on! The rabbis knew what they were doing. There are fences for a reason. When you have something valuable, you protect it. You walk up to the edge of the train tracks, bad things happen. So you paint the yellow line and you say, step back. Exile's a long time. A lot of different cultures we have to go through, a lot of different protections. And the Tzedukim were against rabbinic law. And as they came to believe, anything that's explicit in the Torah, we buy into, we believe, it's for sure true. Anything that needs rabbinic explanation or is rabbinic in nature, total rejection, we don't believe in it. Well, that's going to do quite a number to Judaism as we know it. For example, there are a lot of pretty principal concepts which are not explicit in the Torah, but come through the oral law and teachings of the rabbis' understanding of the Torah. For example, the world to come. The world to come is not mentioned explicitly in the Chumash. If you read through the Chumash from Bereishis to Vezos HaBracha, it does not say in the Chumash itself that when a person dies, his soul returns to its maker. There is an eternity in which the soul will then be judged on its actions, reap the rewards, suffer the punishment, and then be resurrected and come back to life in this world. None of that is mentioned explicitly in the Chumash. It's not. In the Mishnah, in the oral law, replete with references to that. Not only is the oral law replete with references to that, you learn Pirkei Avos, and Pirkei Avos tells you the entire existence we have in this world is nothing but a preparation for the eternity of the soul. Those are two very different worlds you live in. If you live in a world of the sages, you live in a world that every single thing you do in this world is to prepare for the soul's eternity. Everything you do, every thought, every action, every food you eat, how will this prepare me for the world to come? That's how a Jew thinks. Well, if you take that out of the equation, what's your life like? Very different than a Jew who sees the world in eternal terms. But it doesn't say it explicitly in the Chumash. Now, why it doesn't say it explicitly in the Chumash? There is great Torah on that. The Ramban has many conversations about that. It's a question that needs to be asked and addressed. But the bottom line is it doesn't say it explicitly. It's the oral law which teaches us that. The concept of Mashiach. The Jews are in exile at this point in time. The Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed. They were exiled to Babylonia. They've now come back and rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash, but it's not a return of the exile because the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, hasn't come back yet. The yearning for Mashiach, that's not explicitly in the Chumash anywhere. It doesn't say those words. They didn't believe in that. Resuscitation of the dead, divine providence, that there is a God who pays attention to everything. Very Greek philosophy that God created the world and then as a fishbowl, step back and just is watching what's going on. A life that's lived by these without these principles is what we would call a non-Jewish life. That's not a life which is geared to the eternity of the soul, to reward, to punishment. Did I lose myself? I did, hold on. Can you hear me? One second. That's this one, I got it. Sorry. A life that's lived without these principles is not a life Jewishly inclined as we know it. Geared towards reward and punishment. Ask yourself honestly, if you didn't believe, I've had this conversation with many people, or I should say one person many times. If I didn't believe in the world to come, if I didn't believe in the divine soul and eternity, if I didn't believe in that, I would not be doing the things that I'm doing. Why should I? I also would like to be doing other things with my life. But I believe that my life has meaning and purpose and I was created. And there's going to be a judgment. And then there's eternity at stake. That's, you know, this life is short. But that's an internal battle that every person goes through. And the level of belief that one has in all of these concepts, the world to come, the survival of the soul, punishment, reward, resuscitation of the dead, divine providence, these are the bedrock of how we live our life. We now have a movement that we're going to see is going to gain steam, that's going to remove all of them. That's going to take that away and say, you can be a Jew, you could be a Torah Jew, and you don't have to worry about any of those things. If it says it explicitly, great. If not, all of these things that the rabbis have created in the oral law, it's not true. They've been pulling a fast one on us for the last 2,000 years, but we don't really have to observe that. The rabbis, as you can imagine, fought this fiercely. They were led by Reb Shimon ben Shetach, who we'll speak about in a few moments. And traditional rabbinic Judaism did not take this lying down. They saw the threat for what it was, the threat for Judaism to be able to survive, and it was not a pretty time in Jewish history. There are 13 recorded disputes in the Talmud in terms of how the Sadducees and the rabbinic Jews expounded upon various verses, but there were really many more than just the 13. As I mentioned, all of the records that we have from what the Sadducees believed and how they understood Pesukim, they all come from the Talmud. We have no external record. No, it's as if a divine hand just sort of erased them from the scene. There's no record of what they were, what they stood for, other than what the Talmud records, and we have many, many comments about that from the Talmud. Okay, someone have a question? So far, so good. Okay, the Sadducees in power. So how do we come to know about them? How did they gain so much popularity? Well, first of all, there was a major class and economic difference between the Sadducees and between the traditional rabbinic Jews. The Tzukim were generally wealthy. They were Greek-educated aristocrats, and they were very heavily populated and made up of Kohanim. Now, the Kohanim wanted the control and the centralization of the temple, but as the Jews came back, that the temple should still be the centralized force in Jewish law. There were many Kohanim amongst them, and a lot of their disputes centered on practices in the Beis HaMikdash, which have very little meaning to us because we don't have any connection with that, but that's where many of their disputes were, and it was an aristocratic, wealthy, upper-class group. Josephus, when he writes about them, says they were made up only of the rich, and nobody liked them other than the rich. So that's the class that they really controlled. And if you think about it, it makes a lot. That was the culture, the element of who wanted to be in that Greek philosophical approach. The Prushim, the traditional rabbinic rabbis, were made up mostly of the middle or lower classes. They were the Torah observant and loyal Jews. And one of the things that the rabbis wanted to create as they came back and set up Jewish life now in the land of Israel was doing away with class. That there shouldn't be that type of class struggle, doing away with power and lineage. As the Talmud tells us, all of the professions, not all of them, many of the professions of the sages. And it didn't matter if they were a blacksmith, if they were a shoemaker or a tailor. In the world of the Beis HaMedrash, in the world of the study hall, what mattered was your knowledge of Torah. How strong is your logical argument? How strong is your understanding of the piece of the Talmud? And what you did for a living didn't matter inside the Beis HaMedrash. When it came to deciding Jewish law, Torah was supreme, and that was open to anybody. You needed no lineage to be able to study. You needed no money to be able to study. And that was opposing the system that the Tzukim were pushing, which was a very aristocratic hierarchy in terms of how that worked. There's a famous statement that the Gemara makes, and when you put it in context explains a lot. The sages said, a mamzer Talmud Chacham, a mamzer, a child who was born from an illicit relationship, a woman who's already married, has a relationship with another man, and that child is born as a mamzer. A mamzer is not permitted to marry into the Jewish people. He or she is only permitted to marry another mamzer. He's out of the kahal. Sages say, but if he's a Talmud Chacham, if he's a mamzer Talmud Chacham, he has a higher stature than a Kohen who's an Am Haaretz, than an ignorant Kohen. Kohen who doesn't know how to learn. He might be a Kohen, but the sages say, in our world, precedence is given to the Talmud Chacham. He might be a mamzer lineage, I don't care about. What does he know? Kohen who's an Am Haaretz doesn't mean very much. That's the famous statement. You put that in the context of what's going on during the time, and you see the sages are trying to create a culture, the value system. Now, into this, if you flip to the back, your sixth page, I just want to go over a lineage, a little bit of some of the players that we're about to discuss. You'll see at the bottom I created a little chart. My lines are not perfect, but close enough. At the top of the chart is Yochanan Kohen Gadol and Matisyahu. You recognize those two names from? That's their Hanukkah story. Matisyahu and his five sons, who was descendant of Yochanan the Kohen Gadol. And he has his five sons, Yehuda, Shimon, Elazar, Yochanan, and Yonatan. Those are his five sons of our famous Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story doesn't quite end with the lighting of the menorah. There actually is a continued war that takes place between the Jews and the Greeks until things finally settle. It takes almost 25 years, and by the end of that period, only one of the five sons is surviving, and that is Shimon. Everybody else has died. So from the great family of Matisyahu and his five sons, when the Jews finally begin to rule themselves, it's Shimon who takes the lead, and he's the last remaining Maccabee. Now, Shimon were Kohanim. He was descended from Yochanan the Kohen Gadol. So not only was he a Kohen, and he took the position of the high priest, but he, as the last Maccabee, was also the most qualified to actually lead the Jewish people as their Nasi, as their head. Now, a king really needs to come from the tribe of Yehuda. And a Kohen is obviously not from the tribe of Yehuda, he's from the tribe of Levi. So he really wasn't qualified to be a king. But there was nobody more qualified, and so he sort of took the mantle of leadership, so that we now have the Kohen Gadol and the quasi-king in the same person of Shimon. And he is the first Hasmonean dynasty, the first ruler of the Hasmonean dynasty, as it's referred to. Shimon HaTzadik, at the end of the Hanukkah story. Now, he never called himself king. Neither did his son, Yochanan Hyrcanus. And the rabbis were sensitive to the fact that even though both elements of leadership were there in the same person, but being that there was nobody more qualified, and they didn't actually call themselves king, and they sort of gave it a pass and allowed it to be, because that's sort of how it went. Okay, that's the chart. We're going to go back to this. Yochanan Hyrcanus, let's just, while we're there on page 6, he has two sons, Yehuda Aristobulus, and Alexander Yanai. We're going to be talking about them as we understand how the Stukim came to power, so you can take a look at that chart. But what I want to point out is, Yochanan Hyrcanus is literally a son of Shimon, a grandson of Matisyahu, and his children are therefore going to be the great-grandchildren from the great Hanukkah story. We're literally a generation or two after the Hanukkah story. That's where we are right now in Jewish history. So let's pick up back on page 2. So Yochanan Hyrcanus takes over for his son Shimon. Shimon was actually assassinated by his son-in-law. And his son, Yochanan Hyrcanus, takes over, the second Hashmonai king. Now, he was like his father, he was both the king and the high priest, and his reign was from the years 134 to 104 BCE. So we're still before the Common Era, about 100, 130 years before the Common Era. Now, as I mentioned, the rabbis were very opposed to this idea of having both the same person in control of the government as the king and in control of the temple as the high priest. If you remember from our previous courses, we've spoken a lot about the three heads or three different elements of Jewish leadership. We used to have the prophets, you had a king, you had the high priest. There were these different heads, and as things developed, we no longer had a prophet, now we had the sages, we had the rabbis. We still have a high priest and we have a king. So the rabbis were not happy with all of that power being in the same person's hands. It's always a bad idea. You need to have a diffusion of power. In the way that Rabbi Wein, who I quote unabashedly regularly, in his words, inefficiency always trumps disaster. So when you have two leaders, you have an inefficient government. Because now you have a diffusion of power. Look at the U.S. government, for example. You separate power, and what do you have? Inefficiency. But inefficiency will always trump disaster. Because if you have all of the power in one person's hand, so then that works really well when you have a righteous, qualified person. But if all the power is in that one person's hand, and the person is not qualified, it's disaster. Inefficiency trumps that. We'll take it. Now, Shimon the Maccabee and his son Yochanan Hyrcanus never called themselves king. If you look at the coins that they had minted during their reigns, their coins were read, Kohen Gadol, the Chever HaYehudi, the high priest and the leader of the Jewish assembly. Because they were sensitive to the fact that they weren't really supposed to be king. They weren't from the tribe of Yehuda. You shouldn't have all this power in the same hands. And the sages sort of tolerated the system as it needed to be. However, Yochanan Hyrcanus, towards the end of his reign, comes under the influence of the Tzedukim. Now what's going to happen here is going to be similar to what happens to Christianity. It's not until Constantine declares his empire to be Christian and all of a sudden, overnight, Christianity is very popular. So the Tzukim were a sect. They didn't believe in the oral law. They lived the life they wanted to live. They wanted to have a Greek lifestyle. But all of a sudden, one of the kings, Yochanan Hyrcanus, towards the end of his lifestyle, aligns himself with them. And when he aligns himself with them, now all of a sudden, you now have the king of the Jewish people and the high priest believing and part of a heretical sect that doesn't believe in the oral law. When that happens, that's going to change the flavor, obviously, of the entire Jewish people. Now, why did he become aligned with the Tzedukim? So, the rabbis had always been a little bit cold to him, because Yochanan Hyrcanus, now just taking a look at his name, Yochanan, he was most likely named for Yochanan Kohen Gadol, his grandfather, the high priest, most likely. But what's the second name that he's known as? Where did that come from? It's a Greek name. You see the influence and the infiltration already in this son of Shimon, who risked his life together with his brothers to fight the Greeks. And his son is Yochanan Hyrcanus. Now, why were the rabbis a little bit cold to him? Well, there were a number of issues. Number one, we have this high priest-king issue that was holding on to both things at the same time, and the rabbis were always uncomfortable with that. There were rumors about his wife having been taken captive. So that Yochanan Hyrcanus is now a king, there were these rumors that spread, and we'll see one of the passages of the Talmud that we'll read was a discussion. So what's the big deal if she was taken captive? Well, if she was taken captive, there was an assumption that if a non-Jewish group of bandits took a woman captive, that we could pretty much assume that she had been violated by them. Which, as bad as it is on its own, if you're a Kohen and you're married to such a woman, then you have yourself a problem. If you think that your children that you're going to have with that woman afterwards are still going to have the status of a Kohen, because they're not. Since we assume that she'd been violated, therefore the children that she would have would not be fit to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So a rumor spread about Yochanan Hyrcanus' wife that she had been taken captive, and therefore that his children are not fit for the priesthood. The Gemara claims that the rumor was looked into and disproven, but you know as rumors go, it was out there. And he felt that the rabbis never fully accepted him or his children as viable Kohanim. There was another issue of the forced conversion of the Idumeans in the south. Some spell it with an E, I have it here with an I. The Idumeans were a non-Jewish band, a group of tribe that lived in the south of Eretz Yisrael. And when Yochanan Hyrcanus took over, he was afraid that they would eventually group together with invaders that came to take over the country. They were always at war. So he thought that the best way to prevent them from joining his enemies was to force them to join him. And he forcibly converted this entire tribe. Now, as many of you I'm sure are familiar, a forcible conversion has what status in Jewish law? Very little. Just about none. We don't like that at all. And he converted an entire tribe of Jews. So imagine the political mess that you now have. You think about it. Again, there's nothing new under the sun. Everyone's all up in arms in Eretz Yisrael today. Who's a Jew? Who's not a Jew? All these Jews who are converted who think they are a Jew. It's a mess, right? Well, it was a mess back then also, because an entire tribe of people were now brought in by the king and the high priest, who significant portions of the Jewish people, all the Prushim, didn't hold to be Jewish. Except they said, we converted, we're Jewish. So it caused a mess. Rabbis weren't happy with it. The biggest mess that this created was a person known as Herod. Herod the Great, who eventually is going to rise to the throne and take over, came from this tribe and was not well liked amongst the Jewish people. He left us some beautiful structures. But as far as Judaism goes, and Torah Judaism and the lives of the rabbis, he was not pleasant. So meanwhile, Yochanan Hyrcanus converted all of these people as well. He had strong bonds with the Romans. The rabbis were cold to him. And as a result of all of these experiences towards the end of his life, he aligns himself with the Tzedukim, and he creates formally the government of the people of Israel as a Tzedukim government. The Sadducee government. And he kicks all of the rabbis off of the Sanhedrin, off of the high court, and replaces them with Tzedukim. So I just want to explain what that means. You're a regular Jew, you're living in the land of Israel, the second temple stands, and your king decides that the new high court is going to be a Sadducee, heretical, non-believing in the oral law court. And now it's part of Jewish life, that we have this element of Judaism or non-Judaism in positions of power. And when you read certain passages in the Mishnah, it creates a picture as to what life was like. I just want to share, I brought two over here. At the top of page 3, the Rav Elazar ben Tzaddik, this is the Mishnah. The Mishnah Masechet Sanhedrin records that an incident once occurred. There's a discussion in the Mishnah, and Sanhedrin is discussing the four capital punishments. There are numerous different types of various prohibitions a person can violate. And with the time when the high court stood, if there was appropriate warning and there were witnesses, a person would be put to death by the court. One of the methods of capital punishment is known as Srefa. Literally translates as burning, which the sages had an oral tradition, which the Gemara discusses where they got that from. That it means that the way that Sreifa is performed is the neck is forced open by a cord, and hot molten lead is poured down the perpetrator's throat, and he dies instantly. And believe it or not, on that, the Gemara says, how do we know that it's that and not actually burning the person? The Gemara brings the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha. You have to love your friend like yourself, and an instantaneous death like that is obviously far better than being burned alive. So that's the oral tradition that we have. That's how one would carry out the prohibition of Sreifa. The Mishnah records, there was an incident once that a daughter of a Kohen had committed adultery. Now the punishment for a daughter of a Kohen who commits adultery is different than a regular Jew who commits adultery. Since she is of a higher stature in Jewish law, her punishment is more severe. And therefore she is punished with this punishment of Sreifa. And the Elazar ben Tzaddik, one of the Tanayim, the sages of the Mishnah, records, the high court, surrounded her with bundles of branches and burned her. So he records, what's our tradition of this molten lead business? I saw with my own eyes a court surround this girl with these branches and they burned her alive. To which the Mishnah responds, that court, they were not a bunch of experts. They didn't know what they were doing. The Gemara explains meaning, they were a bunch of Sadducees. So I studied this Mishnah my first year after high school. I was learning in Israel. I remember starting this Mishnah, and as I was repeating this, I remember thinking to myself, like, huh? The court weren't experts? I know that. I'm a nobody. I just got here. I'm 18 years old. I learned in high school that the way that you perform Sreifa is with molten lead. What does it mean they weren't experts? What it means is they were stukim. It was a Sadducee court. That's how they did. They had power. They had authority. And if they found the daughter of a Kohen who was an adulteress, they burned her alive in Israel under the authority of the high court of the Jewish state. That's a little bit what life was like. I want to share with you another passage from the Mishnah. There's a concept in the Mishnah, in the Torah, called an Eid Zomim. An Eid Zomim is a false witness, but he's a specific type of false witness. He's a false witness, not who lies about what happened, but the way that we know that he's lying is that he wasn't there to have seen it. Meaning, there was a murder which took place at Turner Field in section 402, and Reuven testifies that he was there and saw the murder took place in section 402 in Turner Field on Sunday. And then two witnesses come in and say, Reuven, we don't know anything about the murder, we don't know anything about Turner Field. All we know is that you were with us on Sunday in New York. How can you possibly be testifying to what took place in Turner Field on that Sunday? You weren't there, you were with us. That's a specific type of false witness. And the unique punishment of that false witness is whatever he was trying to get done to the person he testified against, that's what we do to him. So an example that I just made up, Reuven, who testified that he saw somebody kill somebody in Turner Field, we would kill him. Now, there are a lot of details to this law which we're not going to get into. The only detail that matters is that the only time we'll carry out that unique punishment to kill the false witness is if we catch him at a very specific point in the trial, after the judgment has been given, before it's been carried out. So only if we catch him with the two witnesses after the deliberations and the judgment's been given and we're leading him out, but we haven't yet carried it out, that's where we kill him. We're going to leave aside how this is derived. The Tzdukim, because of the way that this was derived based on the oral law, argued on it. And the Tzdukim said we should only kill him, the false witness, if we catch him after we've carried out the punishment. That's what they held. Which in a certain way is more logical.
If we killed the innocent guy, then we should kill the witness who got him killed. But if we didn't kill the innocent guy, then we... But the Torah law is not that way, but that's what they held. The Mishnah records the following incident, a lone witness. Now in Jewish law, how many witnesses do you have to have? Always two. A lone witness came and testified that Reuben killed Shimon in Turner Field on a Sunday afternoon. Two witnesses come in and said to him, how could you say that you were with us in New York? Now, what should happen in this case is he is absolved, the witness, because he was a lone witness and we don't do anything to him anyway. A lone witness, he had no power in the first place. The problem is, if we let him off the hook, it looks like the reason why we were letting him off the hook is because we haven't carried out the punishment to the guy he testified against, which is what the Tzdukim would say in a case of two witnesses. So even though that we should let the witness walk, but the real reason we're letting him walk is because he's only a single witness. But it looks like the reason why we're letting him walk is because of the Tzdukim way of understanding the law of false witnesses. The Mishnah records, one of the sages, Yehuda ben Tabai, said, I executed that lone witness to counter the view of the Sadducees who said witnesses are not executed unless the accused has also been executed. I just want to again stress what this was like, and this is what Jewish life was like. I killed him. He was an innocent man. Not innocent man. Let me rephrase that. The witness I killed was not an innocent man. He testified falsely about someone else. But he didn't deserve to die by Jewish law. But I killed him anyway. Why? Because if I didn't kill him, it would look like the Sadducee understanding of the Chumash was correct. Because there's a detail that people would get confused about. Again, you read this, when I read this Mishnah, and you scratch your head, and you say, I don't understand. Which is what the Mishnah responds to. The Mishnah says, Shimon ben Shatach says, you killed an innocent man. And yet, it was so powerful a force, the Tzduki drive to be able to say, there is no oral law. Our understanding of things is correct. And you can do whatever you want in life. The sages saw it as such a threat, that there was a sage who killed a man, lest someone think that the Tzdukim have it right. That's what it was like in that period. As Rabbi Wein likes to say, it was a bad time in Jewish history. He, of course, says it with a much better Chicago accent than I have. I know, what can I do? Now, Yochanan Hyrcanus, who begins this path down the Tzduki method... Well, we're running out of time. He had two young sons when he dies. He dies in the year 104 before the Common Era. Now, if you look at your sheet, again, on page 6, the back, just to see. So, Yochanan Hyrcanus has two sons, Yehuda Aristobulus and Alexander Yanai. They're grandsons of Shimon the Maccabee. Alexander Yanai, the younger son, was a powerful person. He was a fierce warrior. He was charismatic. He was handsome as the sun. He was tall in a generation where everybody was short. He was arrogant and he had enough self-confidence to go around. But he had one big problem. He was the younger son. And therefore his older brother, Yehuda Aristobulus, took the throne upon their father, Yochanan Hyrcanus' death. Now Yehuda Aristobulus had none of those qualities. It was clear that Alexander Yanai, if you were to look at the two boys, was far more fit to be a king, and Yehuda Aristobulus was afraid of him. He married a woman named Shlom Tzion Hamalka, who you might be familiar with from the street that's named after her in Yerushalayim. Shlom Tzion was the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, who was the head of the Sanhedrin. So you have a marriage here between Yehuda Aristobulus, who took over as the king. He marries Shlom Tzion, who is the sister of one of the leading Prushim, one of the leading sages of the generation. But Yehuda Aristobulus, who was afraid of his brother, has him arrested and put in jail. And then he takes ill and dies within a year of taking over the throne. So what you now have is the younger brother, who everybody is afraid of because of the force of his personality and characteristics, in jail. And he claims Yibum. because his older brother, Yehuda Ristobolus, who just died, didn't have any children. And he claims the right to marry his sister-in-law, Shlom Tzion, and claim the throne. And Shlom Tzion Hamalka, fearing a civil war between the various factions that were breaking out, agrees. And she, this is why I drew her right in the middle, she, who was originally married to Yehuda Ristobolus, now marries Alexander Yanai, and they will have two children together who we'll get to at the end. Alexander Yanai is quite a personality, as I mentioned. He was a great conqueror king. He's going to reign from 103 to 76 BCE. Part of his conquest, he expanded the borders back to the time of King David. As I mentioned before, when the Jews came back, and during the Hanukkah story, they're centralized around Yerushalayim. He is going to take advantage of the turmoil that existed in the area, which we're not going to get into, between the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucids in the north and all the different things that were going on. And he fills in all the land of Eretz Yisrael back to the borders that existed during the time of David HaMelech. But he's a highly unpopular king. He's unpopular amongst the rabbis because of his behavior and his attitude and his personality. And he's highly unpopular with the people, because for the first 15 years of his reign, all that he did was fight wars. Now, wars are not pleasant. You know, it could be in Athens or in Sparta, they would give a shield to their children and with pride say, you know, come back with it or come back on it. But Jews don't talk that way. And 15 years of war exacted a heavy price on the people, on their children, on their resources. And they weren't interested in it. So he was unpopular amongst the people. He introduced a tremendous amount of Greek mercenary soldiers, as was customary in the day, and was for many centuries to follow. You would hire others to fight your wars. But when you bring in the Greeks to fight your wars, what type of person becomes a mercenary soldier? The highest level of person or the lowest level in the society? So you brought in the dregs of society, which introduced foreign Greek gods, they introduced foreign attitudes and behavior, they all became part of the culture now, and they were actually hired to be the Jewish soldiers. So he was unpopular with what he created amongst the rabbis, amongst the people. And then what he did is he made a very expensive and gaudy crown for himself. And he wore it publicly. And here we find for the first time, one of the Hashmonai kings, he's still a grandson of Shimon HaMakkabi, now puts the crown on his head and says, I am the king of the Jewish people. As a priest, he's no longer from the tribe, he's not from the tribe of Yehuda, but he claims now both the high priesthood and he claims the Malchus, and the Prussian were greatly concerned over this. As their concerns grew, there were numerous other things which led eventually to a civil war. There were two major events which actually created outright civil war amongst the Jewish people. One of them was a celebratory banquet. If you want to read this inside, it's on your addendum, page 5, addendum issue number 3. The Gemara records this at length. I have given you the full Art Scroll translation here. Thanks to Gail Vexer. I appreciate all of your work. The Gemara records that after one of his battles, he returns and had a large celebration in which he had called all of the sages in evil. If you look at the second paragraph, the way the Gemara records this, there was a certain person there who was a scoffer, a man of wicked and lawless heart, whose name was Elazar ben Poriah, and he specifically tried to incite King Yanai, Melech Yanai, as he's referred to in the Gemara, Alexander Yanai, against the Prushim. And he said to the king, you should know the hearts of the Prushim are against you. Whispered in his ears, everybody's having what to drink. He says, you should just know the rabbis don't like you. Now, every king is paranoid, because he has usually good reason to be paranoid. I've heard that President Nixon had a little sign on his desk that said, you would be paranoid too if the whole world were against you. So the kings suffer from that. So now he's got his advisors whispering in his ears, you know, the Prushim, they're against you. They really aren't happy with you. They want you out. And he responds, well, how should I test them? So he said to him, well, why don't you wear the tzitz, one of the garments of the high priest, put it on, which will make everybody will rise in honor of the fact that you're donning this special garment of the high priesthood, and see what happens when you do that. And he does, and one of the Prushim, one of the leaders of the sages, responds, Yehuda ben Gideon said to him, Yanai, be satisfied with your crown of the priesthood.
of the kingship, excuse me. Be satisfied with the fact that you're king, but leave the priesthood to us. Leave that to the Kohanim. Which was a reference to the fact that his lineage was questionable because he was the son of the woman who, in the previous generation, there was this rumor about the fact that she'd been taken captive. So they are still bringing that up, that you yourself are disqualified. So you know what? Why don't you just handle being king, but really you're not qualified to be a priest. And he wasn't really qualified to be a king either because he wasn't from the right tribe. So they began to play on him. Even though they weren't able to substantiate it, the Gemara records, he angrily removed all the sages of Israel from the feast. And then this Elazar ben Poriah wasn't finished, and he continues to instigate and says, if you were just an ordinary Jew, they would have treated you as such, it would be inappropriate. You're the king of all of the Jewish people. King Yana responds on the bottom, well, what should I do? And he says, if you'd listen to my advice, you should kill all the sages who dishonored you. Yana Yamela says, I can't kill the sages. What's going to be with Torah? So Elazar responds, what do you mean it's going to be with Torah? It's right here. Anybody who wants to learn can come and learn. You don't have to be concerned with the Torah. You should kill them out. And the Gemara records on the top of page 6, at that moment, a heretical idea was cast into the mind of King Yanai, and he should have replied, that might be true of the written Torah, it's right here, anybody can come study it. But the oral law, at this point in time, was still oral. It was in the hands of the sages. If I kill them out, what's going to be with the Torah? But he did it anyway, and after this event, he begins to execute all the sages of Israel, as we'll get to in a moment, and the world was left bereft of Torah knowledge until Shimon ben Shetach was able to return it, and we'll get to that in a moment. But this event, the banquet, is one. There was another event which took place during the time of Sukkot. One of the prime services during Sukkot is on the first day of Chol HaMoed, known as the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. I'm sure you have heard of. We have celebrations today and throughout the world on the first day of Chol HaMoed, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. What the Simchas Beis HaShoeva really was when the time the temple stood, there was a service in which the Jews would draw water and they would bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, and along with the wine libations, which were customary, and with all of the offerings, there was a special water libation that was brought on Chol HaMoed Sukkot. The Mishnah records, and I have it in the box on page 3, the bottom of page 3, the sages made a massive ordeal out of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. And again, I want to put in context something which I know I had seen many, many times and didn't fully understand. The sages record on the bottom of page 3, if you did not see the celebration of the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, you never saw a celebration in your life. That was the epitome of joy and celebration. The Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah, which is very concise, now spends an entire 7-8 lines describing in detail what the celebration looked like during this festival. And you read it and you say, what difference does it make? Just tell me it's a big celebration. I need to know. Read the Mishnah. There were 4 golden candelabra and 4 golden bowls atop each, 4 ladders for each candelabra, and 4 young Kohanim, each with pitchers containing 120 lugin of oil. What's the big deal? Again, they made a big celebration. Why the detail? There was not a courtyard in Jerusalem that was not illuminated by the light of the celebration. Pious men and men of good deeds would dance before them, flaming torches in their hands, and say before them words of praises and songs to God. Leviim had harps and lyres and cymbals and trumpets and countless other musical instruments, sing song. And I didn't even bring the rest because it just was too long. What's the source for the Simchas Beis HaShoeva? Any of you remember reading it on the Parshas HaShavua as we read through the Chumash? It's not there. It's an oral law tradition. And the sages made a big deal about it. Sages wanted to establish this is prime. Part of the tradition of Sukkot. And they made a huge celebration out of it. And they gave us details as to how they made the celebration about it. Well, Yanai HaMelech, Yanai, Alexander Yanai, who already is being, who is not comfortable with the sages, and is being pulled as his father was after the ways of the Sadducees, was also the high priest. And he comes into the Beis HaMikdash on Sukkot, and he picks up the water that had been drawn, and he pours it, instead of in the bowl that it's supposed to be poured in, he pours it on his feet. In a show of, there really is no such thing as a water libation. There really is no Simchas Beis HaShoeva celebration. It's a made-up concept because of the Sadducees didn't believe in it. Now,
It's one thing to talk that way if you're in the Sadducee group. But who was in the Beis HaMikdash on the first day of Chol HaMoed to witness the Simchas Beis HaShoeva? It wasn't the Tzukim. They didn't come. It was all of the traditional rabbinic Jews had come to the Beis HaMikdash to see the Kohen Gadol perform the service as it was supposed to be performed. But what are they all holding in their hands as they came on the first day of Chol HaMoed Sukkot? They all have the lulav and their esrog. So the Gemara says, as Yanai HaMelech poured the water on his feet in a sign and show of this is meaningless, the people were so enraged that they pelted him with their esrogim, the Gemara, the Mishnah says. Thousands upon thousands of esrogim come hurling at Yanai HaMelech. Gemara says, it nearly killed him. And he calls in his mercenary troops, and on that day 6,000 Jews are slaughtered in the Beis HaMikdash. In the Beis HaMikdash. Send your husband, your son to the Beis HaMikdash on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and you find out there was a tragedy. 6,000 Jews die. Civil war breaks out. Literal 6-year civil war breaks out between Yanai HaMelech and the Tzdukim and the Prushim. And it was guerrilla warfare, and there were rebellions, and he crushed them all with his mercenary soldiers. The report said there were up to 50,000 Prushim who were hunted down and killed. He literally hunted down all of the sages. There was one instance that's recorded in which there were 800 of them who were he borrowed the crucifixion, which was already in existence at the time, and he had crucified 800 sages on the road leading up to Yerushalayim, and then slaughtered their wives and children while they died their slow death up as they were being crucified. Sages went into hiding. Shimon ben Shetach, who's his brother-in-law, is in hiding. He's underground together with any of the other sages who survived. And as one says, if you were to stomp Jewish history at that point, you would say, it's all over. The government is being run by a heretical group. They're persecuting the sages. Jews in Israel are slaughtering the sages and Talmidei Chachamim of the Jewish people. As the Gemara recalls, the world was bereft of Torah. You have Sadducee courts burning people alive because they think that's what the Torah wanted. The Prushim, Josephus records that the troughs around Jerusalem ran red with Jewish blood during this time. I'm on the top of page 4. The Prushim appealed to Cleopatra's son in Egypt. And he sent a battalion which was filled with Alexandrian Jews. And the Alexandrian Jews and the Prushim fight Melech Yanai's Jews, and they defeat Alexander Yanai. And they begin their march onto Yerushalayim, and the Alexandrian Jews at this point desert. So they say they want nothing more to do with the Jew fighting Jew. They don't want to have anything to do with the ransacking of Yerushalayim. They go home. And Yanai HaMelech realizes the debacle that has taken place at this point. It's been 6 years of civil war, Jew against Jew. And he calls a truce. He calls a truce, and the last 10 years of his reign, he allowed the Prushim to run religious life, and he ran the government. He did not return from his spooky ways, but he allowed the Prushim to control the religious life. And you find another Mishnah, which is quoted around the time of Yom Kippur. There's a Mishnah in Yuma that I have here in the box on the top of page 4, that every Erev Yom Kippur, and again, this is the type of Mishnah which you've come across, you in Yeshiva, you scratch your head and you say, I don't understand what they were talking about. But every Yom Kippur, they would take the Kohen Gadol and the sages would administer an oath to him. And they would say, Master Kohen Gadol, we are agents of the court and you are our agent and the agent of the court. And we charge you with an oath by he, capital H, who domiciled his name in this house, that you will not change anything of all that we have told you. And they would make the high priest swear on Erev Yom Kippur to do the service correctly. And he would turn aside and weep, and they would turn aside and weep, because that's what was necessary. After they regained control of the Beis HaMikdash, after years of Tzduki Kohani Gadolim, the high priests were non-believers in the Oral Law, and they did things their own way. So that when the Prushim took over, they instituted from then on out, that they would make the Kohen Gadol, the only human being who would enter into the Holy of Holies ever, and he would do it once a year, needed to take an oath that he would do it according to Jewish law. That's what society, that's what it had come to.
The Sukkim will last another 200 years, but they never return to power. Their base of power was a Hellenistic philosophy. It was a philosophy based on the Greeks and on maintaining temple power. And when the temple was destroyed 100 years from now, so they had no longer a base of power. What the rabbis had succeeded in doing, as I mentioned earlier, was creating a base that was Beit HaKnesses based. It was shul based. Where the central power did not need to be a temple. It was in the Torah, it was in the rabbis, and it was in adherence to the sages who gave us their guidance. And that allowed them, even after the destruction of the second temple, for us to still be here today. With the Siddur that we have, with the oral law that they gave us, with the Mishnah, and with the Gemara. The Tzedukim are going to disappear. The philosophy of the Tzedukim will not. We will find that philosophy, the idea of doubting the veracity of the oral law, of the authority of the sages to interpret the Torah, of the authority of the sages to enact rabbinic law to protect the Torah. That philosophy to allow one to live a life that they want without an understanding of resuscitation of the dead, a world to come, reward and punishment, that philosophy will rear its head many, many times throughout Jewish history, as it continues to do so today. A philosophy that says that within Judaism, I am Torah observant and don't have to believe in those principles. All of those are the heirs of this philosophy of the Tzedukim, who claim not like the Hellenists, who claim this is Torah Judaism. And the rabbis understood that threat. Two concluding thoughts. Number one is the deathbed scene of Yanai HaMelech. As Yanai is about to die, his wife Shlom Tzion is afraid that the rabbis are not going to permit her children to take over the throne because of their displeasure with their husband, her husband Yanai. Indeed, when Yanai dies, he dies on the second day of Shvat. Now you might say that it's odd that we know the exact date of death of Yanai HaMelech. Do you know why we know the exact date of Yanai HaMelech's death? Because the rabbis made a holiday out of it. In Megillus Tainus, there are a series of dates that are declared to be rabbinic holidays, and the death of Yanai HaMelech is one of those holidays for the threat that he represented to Jewish life, to the massacre of thousands upon thousands of Talmidei Chachamim, and a plot that the sages record that he had intended on killing 70 other specific sages on the day of his death so that they shouldn't be joyous over his death, but they should mourn their loss. And Shlom Tzion found out about it and got out of it. The rabbis made it the celebration of his death on the second day of Shvat as a day of celebration that we were rid of such a king, a grandson of Shimon HaMaccabee. On his deathbed, he says to his wife, "Do not fear the Prushim. Do not fear them. They're good people. If our children are qualified, they'll let them reign. And do not be afraid of the Tzedukim, the non-Prushim. That's not who you should fear." What he said to her is, "Be afraid of the hypocrites who mimic the Prushim, who on the outside look like they're Prushim. The Tzedukim who walk around with the Tzedukhi banner, okay, don't worry about them. It's those who claim to be Torah-observant Jews who really aren't, those are the ones you have to be afraid of." And he quotes a line that has become a poster phrase in Jewish literature, because their deeds are the deeds of Zimri. Ma'osem ma'aseh Zimri. Zimri was the Jewish leader who, in the story of the Chumash, took a Midianite woman and had relations with her in front of Moshe in a sign of active defiance. So Yanai HaMelech says, those Jews, they act like Zimri, u'mevakshin tzchar kipinchas, and they want reward as if they acted like Pinchas who killed them. And that is the Jewish phrase for hypocrisy. To behave like a Zimri and to say, well, I should be rewarded for my actions like a Pinchas. That was Yanai's final teaching that he leaves the Jewish people as he leaves his wife Shlom Tzion. Be afraid of those people. Those who talk out of both sides of their mouth. Those are the ones, the hypocrites are the ones that you have to be afraid of. Indeed, when he dies, his two sons were young, and the rabbis asked Shlom Tzion to actually take over as the queen, which she does. And for 9 years, she rules the country. And when she dies, everybody mourns because they know what's coming, because her two children, Aristobulus II and Hyrcanus II, recreate a civil war. They eventually bring Roman to the equation. And once they introduce Roman to the equation, Rome eventually eats up all of the land of Eretz Yisrael and will destroy the second Beis HaMikdash. So that's what takes us from the story of Hanukkah to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, is this battle, this clash with the Tzduki mentality and philosophy. My final thought that I leave you with is there's a very painful message in all of this. The Civil War exacted a harsh toll. Didn't just exact a toll on the lives of the Jews that it killed, but on the Jewish culture and on Jewish life as a whole. There is a piece from the Netziv, Rabbi Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who lived just 100, 110 years ago. He was a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, in Russia, and he wrote a commentary to the Chumash. And in his introduction to the commentary of the Chumash in Sefer Breishis, he asks the question, why is Sefer Breishis referred to by the sages as the Sefer HaYashar? Now, Yashar is a tough word to translate. It literally means straight or fair, but it's a word which describes Hashem Himself. Tzadik v'yashar hu. He is righteous and fair, correct, straight, accurate. And he asks, why do we refer to this book of Breishis with that name, Sefer HaYashar? And in his answer to that question, he describes that the Jews, I quoted it here, I translated it as best as I could, the Jews of the Second Temple period were righteous and pious and steeped in Torah learning. He's referring to the Prushim. But they weren't Yashar. But they didn't have that trait of being Yashar when it comes to regards to dealing with the world. Because of the baseless hatred in their hearts, they accused anyone who was not practicing according to their understanding of Yiras Hashem, of the fear of heaven. If you didn't practice like them, they called you a Sadducee and a heretic. And when they were quick to condemn everyone who didn't practice like them as a Sadducee and a heretic, it led to murder and all the evils of the world until the temple was destroyed. And for this, Hashem was justified, he writes, in the destruction of the second temple. Because the Holy One is Yashar and cannot tolerate such righteous individuals. If your righteousness doesn't translate into an ability to behave and act appropriately with those around you, he's not interested. Only those who behave in the ways of Yashar, also with their dealings with the world, and not with corruption, even though it's for the sake of heaven, because that causes destruction in the settlement of the world. And this is the praise of the Avos, our fathers, that not only were they righteous, pious, and true lovers of Hashem, but they were also Yashar. And they treated the heathen nations, even the despicable idolaters, with love, and sought only their good. And the Netziv sees that the Avos, he brings from all of them, Avram Davin's first Adom. And Yitzchak and Yaakov, he brings example after example, people who he writes, they hated internally their actions with the deepest sense of hatred, because it went against everything that God wanted for the world. But was able to treat them with love and was mevakesh for that which was good for them. And it did suggest the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was a result of people who l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. But look at all the bloodshed. And it was for the sake of heaven. And to maintain Judaism. Because without the rabbis fighting the Tzdukim, there would be no Judaism today. But it exacted a price. Because when Jews kill Jews, the Beis HaMikdash is the price that we pay. Because God says, this is not a people. This is not righteousness. For the sake of heaven. It's not what I want, he writes. So the battle of the Tzdukim, not only has it left its mark today in that we still have that philosophy that exists, a rejection of the rabbinic authority, a rejection of defenses the rabbis place, a desire to have the culture and the life that one wants without having to worry about the punishment, the reward, and the eternity of the soul. We certainly have that as a heritage from the Tzdukim, but we also have a fierce approach to fight them, and we pay a heavy price in consequence for having to fight that battle too. That takes something out of us. It's not the type of righteousness that God desires. It's not the type of righteousness of our fathers, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And until we can get this somehow figured out, how to fight these two battles simultaneously, how do you wage a war and protect Torah Judaism so that we're still here today and not be guilty of this? Still been a long exile. We're still working on that. But that is the first controversy for our course, that between the Sadducees and the Prushim, the Tzdukim and the Prushim, and we will pick up next week. Rabbi Dr. Michael Berger will be teaching the origins of Christianity, which also stem right out of this period in history. Next week, 7:45. Look forward to seeing you all next week. For those of you who do catch up online with this class,
And if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.